The following audio program is suitable for all ages. It's June 30th, 2005, and you've tuned in to the RetroBits podcast. Hi, I'm your host, Merle Evans. And for the next half hour, we're going to be talking about computing like we did it back in the day. That's right, old school computing. Modern day fun. If it's got 8 bits, paper tape, punch cards, cartridge slots, CPM, BASIC, and ROM, or if it's just plain old, then you've found the right place. This is show number one, a nice binary friendly number. And first off, I'd like to say welcome to the program. For those of you who have maybe found us through a search engine, more information on this show and on upcoming episodes can be found at the RetroBits website. You can find us at www.retrobits.com. And I'm going to start off with some introductions. My name is Earl Evans, and I've been in the computer business for, 27, 28 years now. I cut my teeth on punch cards and a programmable calculator when I was just still in middle school. They called it junior high school back then. And from the first time that I wrote my own computer program in Fortran, I might add, I knew that computer stuff was going to be for me. It wasn't too long after that that a magical event happened. My instructor in junior high computer class owned an Apple II computer, and he brought it in for the people in the class to play with and learn about. When I saw it, I was amazed. I mean, here's a computer, a whole computer, and it fits in this little space. I was used to the idea of computers taking up a whole room. And here's this little thing, and I tell you, it was love at first sight. Pretty much the die was cast at that moment for my hobby, what would be my lifelong career, my passion. And since then, obviously, the computer world has changed big time. In the last few years, some folks have been getting really interested in what it was like in the early days of computing, what it was like basically when I was getting into it. So vintage computing has really taken off. There have been festival style shows, websites have popped up all over the place, and even a resurgence of programming and gaming has occurred with respect to these older systems. One of the things that I've heard people say is that the gaming on the old systems, while it may not have had all of the 3D pizzazz and the surround sound and that kind of thing, the gameplay itself was superior. Now, I'm not going to judge, but I will say that if you don't have a lot of eye candy going for you, then you do have to focus on what makes the game really fun, which is the gameplay. So a lot of people have been getting very interested in this. I kind of felt it myself. I was longing for my old 8-bit Commodore days, and I noticed that on eBay you could pick up vintage computers, and sometimes they weren't that expensive. A seller had a VIC-20 out there. He was advertising it as better than new condition. So I went ahead and bought it, and I found out that he was telling the truth. It was in really good shape. That got me started, and about, I'd say roughly 15 vintage computers later, I found out that I have a bona fide hobby. I've also got a space problem, but that's another story. I'll save that for another time. In the modern day world, lately, one of the things that's interested me is podcasting. I like to be able to choose what I listen to. Lately, I've been getting a little fatigued with standard radio, and I've heard about the podcasting craze, so I picked up some podcast software, downloaded some podcasts, and started listening to it on my PDA on the way to and from work, and it's just wonderful. One of the podcasts that I listened to regularly, called Geek News Central, the host of that podcast wrote a book on how to do podcasting. When I heard about that, an idea kind of popped into my head. Why not do a podcast on retro computing? Kind of hit me that this might be a popular concept, And it could be a good venue for folks to learn and enjoy stuff about the old school computers. And this includes the technology, but I was also thinking if we could convey some of the culture, some information about the colorful personalities that were running around in the older era, building up computers in their garage and starting multi-billion dollar corporations. I lived through a lot of this, but there's still a ton of stuff that I don't know. And I have had fun just researching this first episode. This first episode is on the VIC-20. Even though that's the first computer that I was able to purchase, I did own one. I found out researching this show that there was still a pile of stuff that I didn't know about that particular machine. It was interesting to me, and I figured there might be two or three of you out there who share this interest. So here we are. It's been quite a road leading up to this first effort, including getting up the nerve to actually sit behind the mic and put out some audio content. I sincerely hope you enjoy it. Today's episode, like I mentioned, it does feature a retrospective of the VIC-20 from Commodore. I'll discuss some of the history of the machine, the technology of the box, and some of the cultural nuances of the company that produced it. You may be aware that Commodore produced the VIC-20 as well as the extremely popular successor model, the Commodore 64. Commodore was a very intriguing company. People don't know as much, I think, about Commodore as they do about Apple and Atari and Radio Shack. For some reason, there hasn't been as much history written about Commodore, but they really did change the face of computing. I got just a couple of tidbits on that in this podcast, and I'm thinking we'll probably continue to cover that more as we go into future episodes. Anyway, the VIC-20. Let's get started. I'll jump right into some history on the machine. Like I mentioned, it was made by Commodore. They're the same company who made the PET series of computers. Like I said, they made the Commodore 64, as you might surmise by the name. And later, they produced the Amiga computers, which were also very popular in their day and way ahead of their time. The VIC-20 itself was the first computer to ever sell over 1 million units. This was quite a milestone. It's probably due to the fact that the VIC-20 was priced so aggressively. It was in the $200 range. The computer was touted as the first affordable color computer. It's the first one that ever broke the $300 price barrier. And originally, the computer came out in 1981, May 1981 to be exact, and the last one rolled off the assembly line in January of 1985. An amazing figure, I mean, especially if you consider that computers were not this prevalent back in the early 80s. In 1982, the sales of the VIC-20 reached $305 million. That's just incredible. I understand that at Commodore, there was a lot of turmoil about this, this and later the Commodore 64, because they just didn't know what to do with themselves when the company grew to this extent. So I went out researching, and I found out that there were some print ads and some television commercials that had William Shatner featured. From one of the interviews I read, apparently William Shatner was affordable at the time and was a good personality. Later on, due to some resurgence of his popularity, it got a little bit more expensive to retain him, so he didn't end up continuing on with this series of ads, but you can definitely see him featured on these. One of the ads says, "The first honest-to-goodness full-color computer you can buy for only $299.95." And in another ad with a superlative here, it says, "The wonder computer of the 1980s." You can take a look at some of these ads and see some old television commercial spots in that on one of the websites that I'm going to give you at the end of the broadcast. It'll also be up on our log. It's called CommodoreBillboard.de. Very interesting site. One of the most poignant ads that I saw for the VIC-20 said, "A real computer for the price of a toy." Now, at $300, or just a nickel under, it would have been a fairly expensive toy, but still, the point is taken. This thing was selling very well due to its price. The VIC-20 first came out at the 1980 Consumer Electronics Show. The time that it was introduced, it didn't have a name. They simply called it the MicroPET. And the computer first came out in retail in Japan, and they didn't call it the VIC-20. They called it the VIC-1001. And there's an interesting story behind that. Apparently, 20 isn't as good or as lucky a number as 1001 when it translates into Japanese and with the Japanese culture. So there they decide to name it the VIC-1001. Now, an interesting side note. I've been involved in Commodore for a long time. I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we continue with the podcast. But I noticed that Commodore always had a very healthy following in Europe. I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe I can do some more research and find out why, but Europe was always a very vibrant market for Commodore computers. One, for instance, of that is that there were some follow-on machines to the Commodore 64 called the Plus 4 and the Commodore 16. Those wouldn't end up doing so well in the States for quite a few reasons, but they did okay in Europe, if I remember correctly, and that's where you'll still find a lot of information and even some programming and technical information still going on today. Continuing on the VIC-20, before they were phased out in 1985, these things sold more than 2.5 million units in total. And it was the first computer that I personally could afford to own. Jack Tramiel, the founder of Commodore, had a famous motto. You'll often hear this one quoted. He said that Commodore would make computers for the masses, not the classes. In other words, he wanted your ordinary person to be able to afford a Commodore computer, including poor students like I was at the time. Which kind of brings me back when the VIC-20 first took off, I was working in computer retail. I actually sold these things. The store that I worked at dealt primarily in the Atari 8-bit computers, but eventually we did get Commodore computers. And I had played with a Commodore PET in high school. It had a strange keyboard and not many people wanted to use it, but I was hungry for computer time, so I had kind of latched onto the machine, found out that it was a decent machine with a decent basic and had a very reliable cassette drive. So when the VIC-20 was first introduced to me, I looked at it and it was immediately familiar. I mean, one of the things you'll notice about these Commodore computers is that they have graphical characters on the keyboard. And this goes all the way back to the PET. It was carried forward on the VIC-20. I recognized the branding. A friend of mine named Eric told me about the computer and said, hey, here's a computer that you and I can actually afford to own. So I picked one up. Now, at the retail store that I was working at, there was an Atari users group that met there. And I got to thinking, hey, you know, maybe there should be a Commodore users group in this area. It's a Southern California area, beach cities, Redondo Beach, Torrance, if you're familiar with that area. And I noticed that there was not a Commodore users group. So Eric and I, foolhardy that we were, we just jumped right in and started one. I went out and had some membership cards printed up. And Eric was worried that I would get the $30 back that I'd spent on having those membership cards printed. We didn't know how many members we'd get, maybe 5, 6, 7. You know, maybe there'd be some folks in town who are interested in Commodore. And you've probably guessed where this is going. I mean, this thing just skyrocketed. The first night we had 30 or 40 people. After that, it just kept growing and growing until we were up to 120, 130. We had to change our meeting place. We were packing out the house. And one of the things that I learned from that was that in those days, in the early 80s, mid-80s, the power of the users group, the power of community, was very strong with these computers. It wasn't like you could just walk up and access an internet terminal and find out everything you wanted to know. There was a lot more of people networking involved with using and enjoying the machines. So therefore, users groups just took off like crazy. They were all over the place. And ours was one of them, and it was a lot of fun. Although I remember it was pretty taxing. When you get up to 120, 130 members, you find that the administrative type things that you have to put up with are fairly significant. But I'm telling you, I had the time of my life. And I think a lot of other people did too. It was a really good experience. As the Commodore 64 hit the market, we changed our name. Originally, I'd call this the VicClick, which, despite the fact that it kind of has a exclusive connotation, I still thought, you know, it was kind of nerdy. It rhymes, VicClick, haha. But when we got to the Commodore 64, we decided for a couple reasons to change the name. We became the South Bay Commodore Users Group. Maybe not as clever, but definitely conveyed what we did a lot better. I went back and visited some years later, found out that that users group was still in existence. I don't think it exists anymore today, but it lived on for a long time. That was a lot of fun. But I digress. Should get back to the VIC-20. So that's the history of the machine. Let me talk a little bit about the technology. Any of you who have used a VIC-20 know that it didn't have very many characters across the screen. There wasn't a lot of real estate with this thing. It was 22 characters across and 23 lines down. On a standard television set, those wind up being some pretty big, boxy characters. Downside is, it's difficult to display as much information on the screen as you want. Upside is, the characters are really easy to read. And so you could actually work with the machine, even though it only had 22 characters. Now, there were some clever hacks. I'd used a terminal program when I was in college to access the college mainframe system. And the terminal program that I had used some pixel graphics to bump it up to 40 characters across. I still don't know how they did that because, man, when you add up the numbers, it just doesn't add up. But anyway, clever folks. The heart of the VIC-20 was the 6502 microprocessor. Now, you may know that number because it was the microprocessor that Apple used, the microprocessor that Atari used, and I believe there are other systems that used that chip as well, but most prominently the Apple. The chip itself, as well as the Commodore PET, one of the first computers to use the chip, were invented by a gentleman named Chuck Peddle. Chuck worked at a company called MOS Technology. MOS Technology made chips and some other things, and Commodore eventually bought them. And under the auspices of Commodore, Chuck Peddle took this 6502 chip that he developed, and he made the Commodore PET. The VIC-20 was designed by a person named Bob Yannis. And Bob, if you're out there and if you ever happen to listen to this podcast, if I'm butchering your last name, please look me up on email and let me know. This gentleman also designed the sound chip called the SID for the Commodore 64. The VIC chip itself, this is the video chip for the VIC-20. And it was originally designed to be sold to third parties. This was originally a video controller chip that Commodore thought they would sell to other people who were making video displays or games or something of that nature. But the demand wasn't very high. So Commodore decided, hey, let's make a computer out of this chip. We could recoup some of our losses. The computer had BASIC in ROM, like most of the computers back in that day and age. It was Commodore BASIC version 2. And as BASICs go, it's okay. It's not terrible, but on the other hand, it's certainly not the best BASIC that I've ever used. I would put it on a par above some of the other limited microcomputers of the day, but I would definitely not put it on the same par as AppleSoft BASIC or one of the TRS-80, either level 1 or level 2 BASICs, if I'm remembering that right. Disk access was a little bit of a pain, although there was something interesting about disk access. I'll get to that when I get to peripherals. But you didn't have a directory command or a catalog command. You had to go through kind of a cryptic sequence to get a directory from the disk drive. Now, in addition to graphics, the machine did have sound. It had three voices, and each of those three voices could put out three octaves, but because they were staggered, you could get a total of 5 octaves worth of sound out of the machine. And it also had another voice, if I'm remembering right, that was a noise generator. So between the two, you could get some music and you could get some percussion. The Vic chip itself, the number of that was the 6560. Or if you had the PAL video standard, it was a 6561. And it was designed by Commodore 2 years prior to them actually coming out with the VIC-20. Now, how could you hook up to this machine? What could you do with it? Well, you could program it. You could buy commercial software. But by way of built-in I.O., this thing just had tons of options. Obviously, it had a cartridge port where you could put ROM and RAM upgrades. Cassette interface for the outboard cassette unit that Commodore produced called the C2N. It had what they called a serial interface, which was like a serial version of the IEEE 488 interface that was used on the PETs earlier in Commodore's history. Also, it had a DE9 pin joystick port. This was the same kind of ports used on Atari computers and et cetera for joysticks. So standard Atari joysticks would, in fact, a little later on in the program, I'm going to have an audio segment of me playing a little bit of the game Omega Race, and I was playing it using a classic Atari joystick. One of the most interesting I.O. options on this thing, though, was a TTL level, or 5-volt voltage level user port. And this port had an edge connector that you could get a connector for. You could hook into this. And it was extremely controllable from software. And the fact that it had this programmable, extendable user port made the machine popular with electronics hobbyists. It was popular with ham radio operators. And that capability was actually carried forward into the Commodore 64 as well. I mentioned that when I was in high school that I'd played with the Commodore PET. And that Commodore PET had an extremely reliable, comparatively, cassette data unit. When dealing with the Apple or the TRS-80, you used a common desktop outboard cassette deck with a little sub-mini jack to control the motor. And you had to kind of figure out how to plug it in, how to set the volume levels correctly. And it was not very reliable. In fact, I was most irritated on a couple of occasions when I'd lost my hard work working on a program on the Apple II. But I found out that that wasn't really the case with Commodore. As long as you're using decent cassette tapes, the storage and retrieval of programs on that Commodore cassette deck was just right uptown. It was great. I mean, it obviously wasn't as convenient as a disk drive, but it worked. And that was a very important thing when you just spent hours doing some programming. Commodore did produce some disk drives for the unit. First, they had one called the 1540. I remember these. They were white in color, just like the VIC-20 is. Those didn't stick around very long. They were followed by another unit called the 1541, which is kind of a tan color, same sort of color as a Commodore 64, the classic Commodore 64. It matches. These disk drives use that serial version of IEEE 488 that I was talking about earlier. Unfortunately, because of some hardware glitches that they encountered, it was extremely slow saving off programs and retrieving them from the disk drive, maybe 5-6 times slower than it needed to be. That problem carried on to the Commodore 64. They really didn't solve it until they got to the Commodore 128 and some of the drives designed for that machine. One of these days, we'll do a podcast on the 128, because I got to tell you, in my opinion, that's the finest 8-bit computer that was ever produced. But I don't want to go off on a tangent there, because if I do, we're going to run long. We may run long today anyway. It's supposed to be a half-hour show, but since this is my first one, I'm going to beg some indulgence from you. If it winds up going 45 minutes, 50 minutes, I hope you'll stay with me. I'll try and keep myself in check in the future. So, other peripherals. Commodore made printers as well. It's interesting that the printers that they produced were able to print these interesting, strange graphical characters that the keyboard and the screen could produce. This extended version of ASCII with these graphic characters was affectionately known as Petsky, or sometimes called Commodore CBM ASCII. And using these graphical characters, you could produce shapes. You could draw boxes. You could make other kinds of shapes. And it was interesting. So it was nice that the Commodore printers were able to reproduce these Petsky characters. In terms of other peripherals, one noteworthy peripheral was called the VIC modem. I never owned one of these. As I understand it, the VIC modem was interesting because you had to dial the telephone and then plug in the connection to the VIC modem. It didn't have some of the automation that you'd find in other modems. But for that trade-off, you got a modem for about a $100 price point when most of the other modems on the market were selling for $400 or more. So, hey, you know, you got to like that. The modem itself was developed by Anker Automation, and if you were involved in computers back then, that's certainly a name you'd recognize in that space. Other peripherals included joysticks, paddles, they made cartridges. There's just too much to mention all of it. By way of what software could you run on this thing? Well, first off, I mean, it was a real computer for the price of a toy, but definitely it did have the capability to play some very cool games like Omega Race that you'll hear me playing a little later. You could get some productivity software on it like Home Finance and that sort of thing. As I recall, that wasn't that popular. That could be owing to the fact that the machine only had a 22 character display. So like I say, with that kind of dearth of real estate on the screen, it's difficult to do a whole lot by way of conveying information. So at this point, since I'm talking about software, I think I'm going to take just a break here, a little break, and splice in an audio segment that I recorded a little bit earlier tonight of me playing the game Omega Race. I hope you enjoy it. Here's the audio segment. Okay, I'm sitting here at the console. My VIC-20's turned on. I've got Omega Race popped into the cartridge slot. Copyright 1982 by Commodore, 1981 by Bally Midway, I think is what it said. It's telling me I can press F1 to play by joystick or F3 to play by paddle. F5 will change the screen color. F7 will change the ship color. And, ooh, I get a bonus ship at 40,000. In the year 2003, the Omegan system developed a method of training its warriors to protect their star colonies over the city of Komar. Android-controlled fighters raced to engage and destroy these Omegan warriors. Points were awarded for the ability to neutralize this droid force as follows. And I think after this, yeah, it's going to give me some points. You get different points based on what kind of ship you destroy. Now, I'm going to try and describe the ships to you. They morph through different forms. One form is like a round circle, well, actually more like an oblong. Another form is like that same oblong shape, but with a zigzaggy kind of fringe. Another morph that these things do through time is that oblong shape with the fringe and something inside it that looks like a little crazy asterisk. And then if you play the game longer and longer and you don't destroy all these things, eventually they get super hyper. The asterisk breaks free and starts spinning around the screen, and it's very tough to hit. It's bouncing all over. The game is black and white, looks very vector graphics-like. Your ship that you're piloting with the joystick looks something like the ship that you might see in a game of Asteroids, kind of a triangle shape. You move the joystick forward, you get some thrust, left and right, turn you. And to stop or slow down, you've got to do a 180 and then hit some thrust. As far as I know, you don't have any brakes. Anyway, I'm going to actually play the game here and let you listen to the audio of, you know, an exciting game of Omega Race. So hang on, here we go. I just hit the F1 key to start to play with the joystick. I've bounced my ship up and down so that I'm a little bit harder to hit. And now I'm shooting at the oblong shapes that have the zigzag fringe. There's one of them that's spinning and shooting at me. Uh-oh. One of those triangle things, but I got it. Woo. Oh man, once those things get into hyper mode like that, they start moving around. Now, in the center of the screen is a box that has your score, the high score, and how many guys you have left. The interesting thing is, this box is a barrier. The ships can't get around it. So, one of the strategies of the game is to run around this box in the middle, because it's like a barricade. So you can hide behind it. And let's see if I get this. You hear my little happy dance song? That's because I knocked out all of the bad guys in that one level. If you do that, then you get the little happy dance song, and I think you get some bonus points too, I'm not sure. Oh, you hear one of those guys is starting to get kind of hyper. If I don't get him pretty soon, he's going to turn into a caffeinated Asterix. And he did, and I got him, which scored me some extra bonus points. Man, I'm telling you, my friend and I used to waste so much time on this game. Oh! I won that level, but he took out my ship at the same time. I would get my VIC-20 under my arm, Omega Race. I would go over to my friend Ronnie's house, and we would literally stay up all night. By the way, I just lost the game. So now I'm back at the title screen. Omega Race. Ah, this is a wonderful game. It's very simple, but it has good gameplay. And as you move forward through the levels, more and more of these ships come at you. I mean, it's one of those things that in the end you're going to lose because the difficulty continues to grow linearly as more and more of these enemy ships come out. And in the succeeding levels, they get hyperactive faster. So pretty soon it's just crazy. But we would rack up some pretty good points when we'd play this. And I guess, of course, if you're staying up till 4 a.m. multiple nights playing Omega Race, you know, pretty soon there ought to be a payoff. You ought to get better at it. Anyway, I'm going to turn the mic back over to myself and allow myself to continue with the show. Hope you enjoyed the audio and a little bit of verbal description here of the game Omega Race, one of my VIC-20 favorites. And Earl, back over to you. Well, thanks, Earl. It was kind of strange turning it back over to myself. I was thinking while I was listening to that audio segment that there were a couple of things that I forgot to cover on the hardware, kind of important things, so I'll cover them like really super, super fast. Okay, first off, the disk drives that Commodore produced for these machines had their own processor built in. They were intelligent devices. And the cryptic commands that I was talking about earlier that you had to use to get a directory or store a file or that were the commands to open a channel to this intelligent device and say, hey, I want some data. Give me some data, store this data, etc. So while the commands were at times difficult, at least there was some motive to the madness, and it was consistent with what they'd done on some of their earlier devices. Another interesting thing, the amount of RAM that the computer had. When the VIC-20 when you first pulled it out of the box, it only had 5K of RAM, which wasn't a ton of RAM, and especially when you consider that some of that was taken up by the screen, other kernel functions, it left you with about 3.5K of usable RAM. So with 22 characters across, 3.5K of usable RAM, you had to be creative in terms of how you programmed the thing. Now, they did eventually come out with some expansion capabilities. It didn't take them too long. They came out with a cartridge called the Super Expander with 3K. That gave you 3K of extra RAM, plus it added some commands to the basic language for things like graphics and that. They also had an 8K module, if I'm remembering right, and a 16K module. I've got one of the 16K modules for my VIC-20. And that would bump you up to about 20K of usable RAM. So at that point, you were doing okay. Now, some culture and trivia about the machine. Apparently, the person who invented the 6502 and designed the PET, Chuck Peddle, was not initially in favor of this VIC-20. His belief was that the president of the company, Jack Tramiel, wanted to produce business machines. And this VIC-20 was obviously not going to fit into that category, so he didn't think that Commodore would embrace it. But It turned out that Commodore was enthused about bringing out the machine. In the end, it was pretty wildly successful for them. According to an interview that I read online, I'm going to give you the reference to this site as well. There's a wonderful site called the Rick Mellick Tribute to the VIC-20. It got all kinds of great information from that site. I'll have the URL on the blog at www.retrobits.com. But in any event, interview with Bill Seeler, the original prototyping of the machine involved, get this, they took a PET motherboard and they sawed it in half. I mean, I can just see this happening. It is so old school about the way that you would prototype these computers. And I mean, could you imagine taking a modern day motherboard and sawing it in half and then trying to wire up to it? It's crazy. But they took this PET motherboard, they did that, they wired in the VIC chip, they stuck all of it inside the chassis of an old Commodore calculator, and that's how they built the first prototype of one of these machines. Now, this interview with this gentleman, he called it something that they said at Commodore was a G job. It meant something that was driven out of personal interest, something that they did on their own time. According to another interview with a gentleman named John Feagans, the software and the hardware work for the VIC-20 was done at Commodore's Advanced R&D facility in San Jose. As I mentioned earlier, VIC-20 name wasn't going to work in Japan, and the project manager for the VIC-20 originally wanted to call the machine the Spirit, but it turned out in Japanese that translated into something like ghoul or apparition that haunts you, and nobody wants to buy the Commodore zombie. So VIC-1001 it was. I talked earlier about software. There was some commercial software that you could purchase, but also there were programs printed in some magazines. One of the popular magazines back then for the 8-bits was Compute, Compute with an exclamation point magazine. You get programs in that magazine and type them up. You could also find software that was distributed via some electronic methods, especially if you had one of these VIC modem jobs. You could log on to CompuServe, BBSs. You could get software on cassette or disk at users groups. Users groups often had what they called public domain software libraries, and you could go to the users group and you could access this library and get some interesting software. When we had the Commodore users group that I mentioned before, we did have a software library for both the VIC and then later on the Commodore 64. Another really interesting cultural aspect of these 8-bit computers. Back in the day, there were people who were fans of a particular model. There's some famous Spectrum versus Commodore flame wars on the internet. Atari versus Commodore, Commodore versus Apple, Apple versus Atari, et cetera, et cetera. People were quite passionate. You know, at one level they were just kidding around, and at another level, I mean, they were kind of serious. Some of it was almost scary, but it was fun. Some of the Atari enthusiasts used to call our computers the commode doors. So we took that with a grain of salt. Especially with the Commodore 64, you know, we knew what kind of RAM we were packing. So, and a final note that I'll make on the culture was that when Commodore put out the advertising, the promotion for the VIC-20, they were obviously promoting this machine. They were putting it up in direct competition with game machines. If I had to guess at their motivation, I would say it was if you were going to spend X amount of dollars anyway, then why not get a real computer? And in fact, explicitly, that's what they say in some of their commercials. I'm going to play for you the audio piece of a segment that is freely available at CommodoreBillboard.de. It's of an early 80s TV commercial, and I think you'll enjoy this. Hang on.
There are two kinds of teenagers today. One strives to rack up 30 million points on video games. The other finds it challenging to invent his own game. One depends on somebody else's imagination, the other on his own. One owns a video game machine. The other has a Commodore VIC-20 home computer. But they do have one thing in common. Someday, both will be trying to get into college.
Funny ending. Yeah, they were definitely positioning this thing against game machines and saying that, you know, it's more educational, it's a better investment, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought you might enjoy that. Final thing that I'll do on the VIC-20 show, this first episode, is to cover some of the events that are going on in modern day with the VIC-20. Like I said, there's a resurgence of vintage computing, of interest in these machines. One of the things that's come out of that, and this has gotten especially good in the last few years, are computer emulators, software packages for something like a modern-day Windows computer or Mac computer that can emulate or act like the older computers. There are several of these available for the VIC-20. I'll talk about the one that I'm particularly fond of. It's called Vice, the versatile Commodore emulator. It does a nice emulation of the VIC-20, and one of the things that I like about the Vice package is that it is a multi-Commodore emulator. It emulates a lot of the Commodore 8-bit computers, including the Commodore 64, the 128, and some of the older PET models. So it's a lot of fun. These things have gotten really good. They emulate the sound and the graphics extremely well. They attempt to do true hardware emulation of the disk drives. And like I say, you can get software disk images out on the internet. You can load them into these emulators, and boy, you're just off and running like you had the real thing. And the URL for the Vice emulator, along with a lot of the other resources for this broadcast, will be up on the blog. There's programming going on for these computers. Some of it is in assembly language, and especially when you're dealing with an unexpanded VIC-20 and you've got 3.5K of usable RAM, assembly language is a pretty good bet. If you've got an expanded unit, you've got some other options. There's a cross-compiler, a compiler that runs on a Windows box but generates code for a VIC-20 or Commodore 64. One of them, boy, I'm totally going to butcher this name. It's called Quetzalcoatl. I'm just going to spell it for you. You can Google this. It's Quetzalcoatl. And it's probably a reference to something in literature, et cetera, and I'm just not familiar with it. Now there's definitely software development going on. One program that I saw that was written not too long ago was a sound synthesizer, a music synthesizer for the VIC-20 called VicTracker. They've gotten to the point where it sounds like, if I was reading it right on the website, you can actually hook this thing up to a MIDI sequencer. And oh my gosh, what they've done with this. Now, it does take a 16K RAM expansion to run this program, but the sound that it generates can be integrated into a machine language program that will even run on an unexpanded VIC-20. So I played with this software in an emulator, and I was incredibly impressed. And it's a really interesting sequencer software and for a VIC-20. So, hey, like I say, there's stuff going on for these things. If you have a real VIC-20, a real Commodore computer of just about any of the 8-bit variety, and you want to get some of the software that's out there on the internet, and you're thinking, how am I going to do this? If I've got a modem, maybe I can download it. But there actually is another way. There's a series of cables called the X series of cables, the X1541 cables. There's an XE1541, XA1541. And these cables connect the parallel port of a PC to an honest-to-goodness Commodore disk drive. And with the right software, you can download a disk image from the internet, and you can copy that virtual disk to a real disk in a Commodore drive. As I was talking about before, these Commodore drives operated with a serial interface, but the voltage of that interface was compatible with the voltage that you're going to find on the parallel port on a standard PC, and with some extremely ingenious wiring and software trickery, they're actually able to make a PC talk to one of the Commodore disk drives. And you can do the reverse. You can have a Commodore computer that you hook up with this cable to a PC, and the PC acts like a huge file server for the Commodore. Even a 1.44 megabyte floppy disk is a lot of room when you're talking about these Commodore computers. And when you're talking about modern day hard drives, you can just store tons. There even are hard drives out there that will plug directly into the Commodore. A manufacturer that made these is called CMD. I believe that their assets have moved over to another company at this point, but I believe the drives are still produced, and that's something that you could Google for CMD hard drives, or you can find them on eBay as well. CMD made a number of peripherals for the Commodore computers. So, where to go to find more information? Well, if you're interested in this cable that I just talked about and some of the software that will run it, you could check out the Star Commander website. And that's at sta.c64.org. Other websites, and I thank them profusely. Thank you that I used for research on this episode. One is old-computers.com. That's www.old-computers.com. Fantastic website. All sorts of computer information on there. Forums where people can add information, links to emulators and other resources. Just, I love that site. The VIC-20 tribute site that I mentioned before, the Rick Melick VIC-20, I'll get this out eventually. This is a long URL for this tribute site. It'd probably be safer just to go to the blog at www.retrobits.com, but I'll read it off. It's www.geocities, that's G-E-O-C-I-T-I-E-S, .com/rmelick, R-M-E-L-I-C-K, /new_page_2.htm. If you didn't want to write all that down, definitely go check out the blog at www.retrobits.com. We got it there. Wikipedia is an interesting online encyclopedia that's edited just by the general public. It's like a general resource, and they had a great article in there on the VIC-20. You could find that at the English version of that is at en.wikipedia. That's wikipedia.org/wiki/VIC-20, and it's capital V, lowercase ic, dash 20. Great article, lots of information. I also mentioned the www.commodorebillboard, that's one word, .de site where you can find those old commercials and print ads. And the VicTracker software, that MIDI sound synthesizer sequencer software, you can find at www.kahlin.net/Daniel, that's D-A-N-I-E-L, /VicTracker. And, of course, the last URL that I'll give of the night is for the RetroBits.com website. You can find the show notes, other blogs, a link to the forums, etc. at www.retrobits.com. And, wow, I'm way over, but that's it for this episode of the RetroBits podcast. And I sincerely hope you enjoyed it, that you'll tune back into us next week. For information on upcoming shows, you can visit our website. I'm your host, Earl Evans, and I'm rebooting for now. It's getting kind of late in the evening. Thanks again for tuning in. I'll see you next time.